Welcome to the Educause Podcast. You can find more podcasts on a variety of topics by visiting www.educause.edu/podcasts. You can also find us on iTunes by searching for Educause. This podcast features a keynote address from the Educause 2010 Security Conference. It's a speech by Marcus Sachs, Executive Director for National Security and Cyber Policy at Verizon. His presentation is entitled Cyberspace, a Matter of National Security.
Like Kathy said, I am a student at George Mason. Late in my career, I'm gone back to work on a PhD, and my kids think I'm absolutely have lost my mind, because why would an adult go back and get educated? Aren't you smart enough, Dad, the way it works? But no, you always are seeking more things to do. So the PhD I'm working on is in public policy, which is what I do at Verizon. A little bit about my background. I'll put up my little disclaimer here. This is what the lawyers say that I have to do. As Kathy said, I retired from the Army. That was back in 2001. 20 years, Corps of Engineers, built bridges, blew things up. You know, the joke in the Army is the engineers build targets and the artillery blows them up. And that's essentially what I did. But along the way, I was also running computer networks and writing software and things like that. And Uncle Sam, after a while, figures out what you're really good at. And while I liked engineering and building things, it turned out I was more better at networking than many of the people in the Signal Corps. And so I wound up moving into more of the communications side, which is where I spent the second half of my career building and designing networks, and was stationed at Fort Bragg. And we would jump out of airplanes, perfectly good airplanes, mind you, with laptops and Ethernet cable and soldering irons and little barrel connectors. Remember the good old days when Ethernet was in, right. And so we would do stuff like that. So the guy next to me on the airplane might be carrying a machine gun with ammunition. I'm carrying two laptops and a bunch of floppies. And here we are jumping out of airplanes. So a very interesting experience and a fun way to really kind of get into networking. By the way, when a tank runs over Ethernet cable, the Ethernet cable is not happy. You run fiber optic over the ground and a soldier steps on it, fiber optic's not happy. Try doing networking in that world. It's very different from wiring up your buildings and things where everything is nice and behind the walls and so forth. I was at the White House for about a year and a half early in the Bush administration. This was after September 11th. And after that, I was part of the CSIS Commission on Cybersecurity for the 44th Presidency. When we stood this up, this was the end of 2007, so it was a full year before the election. We really had no idea who was going to get elected. If you're a Republican, you were probably thinking Giuliani was going to be the candidate. And if you're a Democrat, you were probably thinking that Hillary Clinton was going to be the candidate. Of course, everything changed over the next year as the election process bubbles. But we were trying to keep cybersecurity separate from the politics. So we wanted to have a set of recommendations for whoever the president was going to be. Of course, ultimately, we found that out, and we delivered to the Obama incoming administration, December of 2008, a complete package of here's what to do in cyberspace. Now, unfortunately, as things happen inside of Washington, you get all this stuff that builds up. People want to do things, and there's a lot of momentum. Everybody's real proud of themselves. But how far have we come? What is anything big happening in Washington right now when it comes to cyber? Big legislation, you know, big muscle movements. Yeah, not like we would like it to be. We have a cyber czar, cyber coordinator. Howard Schmidt's been appointed to the White House. White House did a 60-day review. There's all kind of bills in Congress. But unfortunately, right now, the interest of the federal government, as you probably are all aware if you watch the news, is on health care, immigration, jobs, the economy, bailouts, anything but cyberspace. They may talk about it, and they'll have hearings from time to time, but the interest of the federal government is not necessarily there. That's not good. And I'm going to make a case here as we go through this morning. We are sitting at a crisis, or a crossroads, I should say, with our country, a decision point that we have to make. Are we serious about cybersecurity, or is this just a bunch of talk, a bunch of hot air, a bunch of ways for people to profit off of it, to sell themselves as security professionals because we have a lot of scared people that will buy their services? Each one of you have got to take this to heart. The future of our country depends on you and depends on our profession to do the right thing, to make the right choices now. So let's go backwards a little bit in time and talk about how we got to where we are today. Why is this such a mess that we're sitting in? And what I'm going to do is bring you kind of up quickly, bring us up where we are today, and then I'm going to focus on the threats that we have, all the different types of bad things that are going on. I'm going to show you a bunch of examples. And I'll wrap all this up by making the case of why this is a national security problem and maybe some of the potential things that could come out of this, things that if we sleep at the switch could happen, or things that might be better if we get a little more involved. Some of you were probably involved in the early ARPANET. I see some of the gray beards around here that go back to the late 60s, early 70s. Foundational work, awesome work that was being done at the time. But back then, for those who were involved, particularly for those who were building networks in the 1970s, if you remember, it was a different culture from today. It was very open, very sharing, very getting along. It was researchers that knew each other. It was military, government types. It was a nice, tight-knit family that were building networks. And a lot of trust in the end people, the actual humans that are on the ends of this network, bringing it together. Home users, businesses, not really part of this game. If you owned a home computer in the 70s or the 80s, if you were lucky, and my first home computer I bought in 1981, do you remember the Commodore, VIC-20, and C64, that kind of world, as many of us kind of grew up? The best we could do in terms of connecting was a 300 baud modem. Remember when 1200 was fast? And 9.6 was like screaming? And 14.4, oh my God, how can I, what am I going to do with all this data? And then 56K, boy, life is good. Remember those days? That wasn't too long ago. And that's back when we were, you know, kind of building this and making it happen. Well, things began to change as networks began to grow, packets began to flow, endpoints for big, large mainframes, not little small computers or handhelds or whatever, we're, you know, chip implants, maybe that's what the next thing that's coming up. New technologies came along, FTP, Telnet, SMTP. A lot of those technologies baked in back in the 1970s. Are they still here today? Yeah, largely unchanged. Unfortunately, largely still with all their security issues. Go look at the original man pages for FTP and Telnet and SMTP and all those kind of bedrock protocols. If you can find those original pages, look down at the bottom in the known issues section. Remember how we used to document all that stuff? Down there in the bottom of that man page, down there it'll tell you, we know there is a problem with spoofing. We know there's a problem with sniffing. We know there's a problem with clear text passwords. Well documented. But yet those protocols still exist today. They're baked into the internet. This is fundamentally why we're having problems. The internet was never built to be secure. It was built to be an open, sharing, kind of trustworthy thing where people would not abuse this. I mean, it's hard enough to make the networks work. Why would somebody try to abuse it? There's other things, new problems, tunneling, spam, phishing, things that have come along since those early days, but all of them can trace their roots to fundamental decisions, and nobody's making wrong choices back in the 70s. I'm not faulting anybody there. The culture was just completely different, a culture of trust. Now, you bring that forward to today, to 2010. Have any of these protocols changed? Yeah, we wrap stuff on top. We say, not DNS, but DNSSEC. It's not IP, it's IPSEC. It's not BGP, it's secure BGP. What are we really doing? It's just a wrapper that we're putting around it. We're calling it secure, but in its heart, it's still broken. It's like having a cut on your hand. You put a Band-Aid over the cut or a wound, and you forget to take the Band-Aid off, and the skin grows over the Band-Aid. I know it's kind of gross this early in the morning, but the problem is still there, and it's still covered by a Band-Aid, even though it's got skin over it and you can't see it anymore. That's where we sit today on the internet. All these old problems are still there. They're still causing issues, and this is what the adversaries used to get in. Now, all was well till the early 90s. That's when the unwashed came in the door. You know, those who were clueless had no idea about all this trust that we wanted to put into cyberspace. People like you and me and my kids and my grandmother and my wife and everybody else all just started, and even me, connecting up to the network, to this pristine, beautiful thing, bringing in all the filth of society. But the filth of society has built a pretty cool thing over the last 20 years, right? I mean, what we have built is unbelievable. In the short period of time, from the early 90s to 1999, just that brief decade, we went from virtually nothing, dial-ups and bulletin boards maybe was the best we had, all the way up to this dot-com explosion. Have we ever had anything like that in the history of mankind? Where we went from virtually nothing to full bore in 10 years, less than a generation. So yeah, lots of room for error, lots of mistakes that were made along the way. That's okay, but we need to recognize that fundamentally, this is some of the problems that we see today. So today's internet, there is no king of the internet, there is no president of the internet, no potentate, no company that runs it, nobody there, we all just get along. When in human history have we ever had an opportunity like this just to get along with each other? It's kind of like being back in kindergarten where you tell little Susie and little Johnny, to cooperate and share, get along. And that's what we're trying to do on a global scale. This bothers businesses, it bothers nations and countries and people and religions and politics, because human society doesn't just get along. We like to fight with each other. We have turf battles and wars and things. And the internet's trying to say, no, do all away with that. We want to just get along. And again, fundamentally, there's a problem there in the way human society and the internet comes together. So the trust model, this thing that we built back in the 70s where everybody trusts each other, is completely gone today. We can't trust each other. But the electronics inside the network, the protocols, the way the internet works is still based on that original trust model. Does everybody kind of see where I'm going here? This is fundamental to why we're having the security issues we're having. Because many people are saying, can't we just fix this? Can't we just like pass a law or something to make the internet secure and make crime go away? Well, no, you can't. This is inherent. It's built in. It's like trying to build this big, beautiful 72-story skyscraper that we're having this conference in out of wood. Could you imagine building this thing out of 2x4s? It won't work. We had to have the science of the 1800s to build it, to come along with steel and structure and bending and learning all these cool things I learned up at Georgia Tech in my civil engineering days. All that had to happen in order to build these big towers. That's where we stand in terms of networking. We have not gone through that phase yet. We're still building with sticks. We're still building Roman arch bridges. We don't know why they stand up. They just work. At some point, we got to get past that. We got to start thinking about the science behind networking, the engineering behind networking. And maybe our kids or our grandchildren will benefit from that. So in the last 15, 16 years, we've gone from tens of thousands of websites. I did a check last night just to verify my stats here. I love Netcraft. They're the ones that keep track of all this neat stuff. And in fact, they showed a peak back in December, January, that was up around 220, 230 million websites. These are individual domain names that have a www kind of presence online. It's actually gone down, a reflection of the economy, where websites are actually shutting down. But still, the number is a little above 200 million. That's awesome when you think about it. Now, it's been about 5 years since anybody was actually counting pages. Yahoo was the last one to do that. Google does not release their statistics, so Google would probably be the place to go. They could tell you exactly how many pages, and I'm not talking document content, you know, ASP pages, things like that, but actual stat pages, like the first page you come to, an index.html kind of page. Yahoo released statistics in 2005. There's been no further statistical releases since then. Google keeps it all a secret, so the best you can do is go back and look at what Netcraft said back in 2005, what did Yahoo say in 2005, do a little bit of basic algebra, and then you can deduce about 50 billion web pages today, plus or minus a billion. That's a lot of web pages, folks. That's a lot of information. Do you think we're done building this internet? We have just barely scratched the surface. Come back next year, and that 50 billion will be 60, and come back in 10 years, and we'll be hundreds of billions. How are we going to track all this stuff? And we're up to about roughly a third of the planet now online and growing. Isn't that phenomenal when you think about where we are and where this is taking us? But all this goodness, all this beauty, everything we've come together, the Garden of Good. We've all seen that movie, right? It's filmed in Savannah. There's evil. There's evil lurking out there. And back in the 1970s, nobody would attack these networks because, heck, they broke all by themselves. I mean, everything was connected by AT&T. Remember, I'm a Verizon guy. And so, you know, AT&T's network's really kind of crunchy. We have this thing called, there's a map for that, you know, that shows you all this fun stuff. I don't mean to bash AT&T. They're a great company. But gosh, I love competition. So much fun. Oh, and I forgot to say this right up front. If you have a little wireless device in here, everybody always tells you at conferences to be sure and mute them, turn them off and all that. If you're on Verizon Wireless, if that thing goes off, I don't care. That's great. That's awesome. You know, make a phone call, do whatever you need to do. So, hey, you know, pays my bills. So in the 1980s, a lot of papers began to come along, academic thinking. How do I break this stuff? It was a very fascinating time. Morris worm, concept virus, things began to show up. But the 1990s, remember the unwashed came in, the early 90s. So that was a huge changeover decade where we began to see real live attacks, website defacements, worm viruses. Remember fighting all that stuff? It seemed like every day there was a new website that had been defaced. I remember watching the FBI's website get defaced and DOD, and I just got introduced to SANS in those days, and SANS's website got defaced. I mean, this was just horrible because there's Fluffy Bunny. Remember Fluffy Bunny sitting there on SANS's website? I mean, I know I'm kind of ruminating a little bit here, but those were the days. And then this past decade, post September 11th, everything changed. All that noisy, adolescent, really cool website defacements with all the fun things they put on there, all that kind of went away, and the value attacks began. Organized crime, espionage, nation state warfare, things like that all begin to kind of creep in. You have to ask the question, though, what is this decade bringing us? What's the next evolution? So I've coined a little phrase. It's kind of geeky and corny, but I like to call it cloud seeding. Everybody says the cloud's coming. We're going to the cloud this, the cloud that, whatnot. And you probably know about how you can make rain where there is no rain, as in silver iodine into clouds. Watch the hacking community as cloud computing comes of age. Watch them go in and build fake clouds. Watch them create weather systems, quote-unquote, inside the cloud that don't exist otherwise. How will you tell the difference? How will you know that this is a real cloud versus this is a fictitious cloud? How do you know that this is, in a meteorological world, real rain versus man-made rain? You're not going to know. I'm predicting that's what we're going to see in this decade coming up. It's going to make the stuff behind us seem as childish as what we saw in the 1990s. As we move forward. And what comes after that, who knows? Let's meet back here in 10 years and see where this takes us. Well, back in the late 90s, the Defense Department did a study trying to figure out where were things going? What are the threats kind of looking like? And they came up with a very good threat model that a lot of us like to use. It just takes from lots and lots of hackers. In other words, the probability of occurrence of a hacker is really, really high, millions of them. But the amount of damage that they could do, a single hacker is pretty low. Does that kind of make sense? Everybody? And you could rank it up to there's not a lot of state-sponsored cyber threats, but any one of them could do an awesome amount of damage. And, you know, it's kind of intuitive that there's this line here from lots of hackers, but not a lot of damage, up to not a lot of countries, but a lot of damage. Their insight, though, is that this line continues to march outward as the years go by, so that hackers tomorrow will have the same skills as today's criminals. Hackers a few years from now will have the same capability as today's spies or terrorists, etc. That's an interesting insight. You have to ask yourself, though, what about the defensive community? What about the system administrators, the firewall programmers, other people who are trying to protect ourselves? Is that same curve happening? You could make the argument that the piece on the right would be your users, lots of them, but each one of them not very effective. And the ones on the left may be, you know, your uber geek, onesies and twosies security professionals, not a lot of them, but one single thing they do very effective. Is their line moving outwards? Yes. But is it keeping pace with the threat? No way. These guys are way in front of us, way in front of us. And again, a lot of it's because of the technologies that are inside the internet. So if I took all of today's threats and just kind of ranked them, I'm not going to read through this, but you can kind of see from hackers at the bottom up to nation states at the top, and these slides are available, so feel free to read them later. I'm going to focus in on the top two or three, just a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes, what's happening with cyber warfare, with espionage, with crime. I'm not going to talk about the terrorists. We thought back in the late 90s, early part of the 2000s, that the terrorists were going to be the next big threat. That they're going to terrorize us through the internet. They're going to blow things up. Remember all that stuff? Where'd the terrorists go? They're still there, but they don't terrorize us on the internet. What do they use the internet for? Make money. Yeah, they're businesses, most of these terrorist groups. They're not going to blow up their business. This is where they can make money. And then they can go off and hijack airplanes and cut people's heads off and do all the things that terrorists like to do and put the videos online and scare the crap out of us by showing these kind of... They're not going to destroy the internet. So we tend to kind of... We've taken the terrorist groups off the table a little bit now in terms of threats, but we'll focus in... Let me focus in on these other ones here briefly. So cyber warfare. This is kind of really new esoteric stuff, and some people would even argue there is no such thing as cyber warfare. In fact, warfare is warfare is warfare. It may bleed into cyberspace, but there's really no difference there. Two nations that are at odds with each other might do things. But looking at it historically, as humans, we've always sought ways that we can inflict pain on some other human by getting away from them. I mean, if you go up to, you know, your Og the caveman and Grog the other caveman has pissed you off, you know, you might hit him or take your club or something, but Grog, the other caveman, can hit you right back. I mean, you're close, right? So people started to develop ways that I could stand off, being able to throw rocks, slings, arrows, catapults, guns, cannons, intercontinental ballistic missiles, anything where we can get further and further apart from each other to inflict pain on whoever it is that we're in conflict with. What does the internet bring to us? almost perfect standoff, nearly instantaneous. Within milliseconds, I can inflict pain from thousands of miles away, and I can do it nearly anonymously, very cheaply, very inexpensively. In fact, I'll talk about espionage in just a second, same kind of concept. So this should not surprise anybody that the internet has become a place of conflict, because it's just the normal, natural human evolution of when we don't like getting along with each other, let's use means around us to inflict pain. How many of you are aware of the CIA project called the Farewell Dossier? Anybody heard of this? Couple of you. This is worth checking into. It's a very fascinating little look back on history. 1982, Reagan administration, remember the evil empire, as Reagan used to call the Soviets? So we found that the Soviets were stealing Western technology, what today we would call SCADA, CS, you know, kind of stuff, pumps, motors, things along those lines, electric-controlled machinery, in order to build a refinery in Siberia. So rather than building their own stuff, they're stealing it from us because they want to get a lead start on it instead of having to go through all that R&D. We found out about it through some intelligence gathering. The CIA, instead of cutting this off, let's give the Russians the pumps and motors and computers are trying to steal, but let's give it to them with a value-added feature. And so we allowed them to steal this stuff from us, but it was poisoned. And they built their plant, and we blew the plant up remotely. And the explosion was so big, our satellites picked it up and thought it was a nuclear detonation. In the age of strategic arm limitations, the Russians and us are not going to do any more blowing up nukes, this kind of stuff. The rumor was, or the story goes, that in the White House that day, people scurrying around because reports are coming in that the Russians have blown up a nuke, and CIA people come up down there. It's almost like one of these Star Wars Jedi things. This is not the nuke you're looking for, you know. Go back to where you were, whatever you were doing. Or like in Red October, when the CIA director comes in and presses the button, then shows his little card, says, "I was not here," you know, that kind of. So they just tell everybody, shh. Just go back to what you're doing. You don't need to know about this. It's all come out today. You can read about it. Just Google for it. In fact, the CIA has a whole webpage devoted to what actually happened. It's a fascinating story. What does this show? The United States has the will and the capability to remotely cause pain against our adversaries using internet-like technologies. Granted, the internet was very different in 1982 than the way it is today. We have the resolve to do this. If we were willing to do it back in the 80s, you think we're willing to do it now in 2010? You think the Russians are willing to do it to us? The Chinese, the Germans, the French, the Japanese, all our friends, the Australians? Of course, we're all into this stuff. Everybody likes doing this. So a couple of case examples. Everybody's familiar with the Estonia thing, right? You all heard this has almost been beaten to death. Just in case you haven't heard, there was an uprising in Estonia because of a war memorial that they wanted to move. The Russians didn't like that. Estonia is an interesting country because of their connectivity. When they declared they were granted independence from the Soviet Union back in the mid-90s, they immediately grasped this internet thing, and they very quickly became a very large internet economy. There was virtually no cash today in Estonia. Everything's done on plastic or electronic transactions. So if you go after the computer networks in Estonia, you can really cause a lot of damage to a little country. And that's exactly what happened. It was a classic denial of service attack using bots and things. Not a big deal technically, but it did shut down the country for three separate times over a period of 2 or 3 weeks. And it really grabbed our attention. It started raising some interesting questions, and also the attacks on Georgia the next year. What does all this mean? Has the age of cyber conflict, cyber warfare, actually gotten here? What we don't know, and even today in Washington, we don't know this. What is our response? What is the United States' response to a cyber attack? Who owns that problem? Is it a State Department problem? Is it a Defense Department problem? Is it a commercial private sector problem? Who responds? We keep asking these questions in Washington, and we kind of get the, well, we're working on an answer. The old administration, the Bush administration, had no answer. Current administration has no answer. The question was never asked during the Clinton administration, so we don't know what their answer would have been, but probably there would have been no answer there either. This is hard, hard stuff. Internet, as you know, understands nothing about politics. It doesn't understand religion. It doesn't understand borders. It just hyperconnects everybody. So how do you divide this thing up? In fact, a question that comes up often is, what is private property in cyberspace? And if you're going to have war in cyberspace, you know, in classic war, you fight it over private property, but once it's done, the victor you know, either owns the private property or something comes of that. But private property owners in general have some way of getting paid back, reconstituted, you know, whatever. Well, how does that work in cyberspace? And to get really, really awkward, how does our Constitution work in cyberspace? You know, Georgia is one of these states that honors the Second Amendment, allows concealed carry, things like that. How does that work in cyberspace? Am I allowed to conceal carry if I'm here in Atlanta while I'm online? And what does that mean to conceal carry online? Can I shoot somebody? Is there a castle doctrine around my computer? Really cool questions. Nobody's got any answers to it. I mean, we talk frequently about the First Amendment, freedom of speech, but what about all the other amendments? How do they apply inside of cyberspace in a highly connected world? Do private companies have the right to sovereignty? Does my company, Verizon, if we don't want to participate in a future cyber conflict, can we make ourselves like Switzerland and say, yeah, you can fight all day long, but just use AT&T's networks. Don't use mine. We're profiting from this. We don't need your smelly cyber stuff or cyber warfare bullets floating around our networks. Besides, wouldn't that make my routers part of the conflict? Wouldn't that make them then targets of the adversary? And I don't need my routers being targets. I need them moving packets. I need them doing good things. Things that we like to do online. So you see where I'm going with this. This raises just tons of questions about what does this mean if we're going into this world of cyber conflict. Espionage, kind of the next level below that, has also raised the same sorts of questions. If you go back to that old Cold War mind model, it costs thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to train a spy, to train somebody in the Soviet Union, to train somebody in the United States, whatever, so that we could spy on each other. Today, how much does it cost to spy on the United States if you're one of our adversaries? Virtually nothing, right? You can go to an internet cafe, you can go online, you can use your wireless phone for us to spy on them, them to spy on us. Do you think there's any country out there that's not spying on another country? I mean, we all do this. In the corporate world, do we spy on each other? In academia, do we spy on each other? As private citizens, do we spy on each other? Yes. Come on. I see you smiling. No, not me. The person next to me, but not me. No, this would never happen. We all do it, folks. We're all voyeurs. Admit it. We want to see what other people are putting out there. We check out the stuff that they're laying out. Most everything that's stealable, we're giving it away. I love Google. All of you really know how to do the little Google incantations like site colon something. Like put in TSSCI, Top Secret Secure Compartmented Information, site colon dot mil. See what comes back. Or put in for official use only, site colon dot mil or site colon dot gov. It's amazing what stuff comes back that should never be online. And my absolute favorite is the dot XLS. What does it stand for? Spreadsheets, right. So in Google, type in SSAN, that's Social Security Administration number, file type colon XLS. Should anything come back? Should there be any spreadsheets on the internet that contain Social Security numbers? I should get no hits, right? Yeah, go entertain yourself. And look at how much of this stuff comes back. Folks, we put so much information out there, it's no wonder they're spying on us. We're giving it away. Of course, the other side's doing this as bad as we are. But where this really gets bad, it's not just the stuff we're giving away, but our adversaries now beginning to worm into our government and military networks and the contracting community. All these big, what we love to call in Washington, the Beltway Bandits. That's the Northrop Grummans and the Boeings and the Booz Allens and the SAICs and all those good companies that protect us with all their assets and their capabilities. They are targets just like the federal government. Our academic networks, targets of foreign adversaries. In fact, they've been targets probably as long or longer than most of the ones that are currently being targeted. Did any of you ever work the Moonlight Maze case? I'm not saying anything classified. It's all unclassed now. Moonlight Maze was an episode a little over 10 years ago where we found what we think were the Russians breaking into lots of academic networks looking for really strange things like bathymetric data, atmospheric data, cockpit designs, things about the environment and the world around us. Why would the Russians care about the last 30 years worth of atmospheric information about weather conditions on the planet over the last 30 years, but that's what they were stealing? Why would they care about ocean currents and things like that, but that's what they were stealing from colleges and universities? Because that's where the information was. Today, what are we seeing? China in particular is breaking into industries and stealing all the electricity data. Like, how much power do you use every minute of the day? You know, what does your power cycling look like? They're stealing information about set points. This is a SCADA term. How am I setting all the control systems in the control world? They're stealing that information. Why would China care about all this information that's inside of our factories? Well, it turns out, and this was revealed in testimony about a half a year ago in the United States Senate, that there are a number of factories now being built in Southeast Asia that are exact copies of factories here in the United States. Perfect, exact copies. Where'd they get the blueprints? They stole them online. Where'd they get the knowledge about how much power to build into that factory? They stole it online. Years worth of our intelligence building, our capabilities, our intellectual property are just being stolen from us, ripped right out from underneath us through this persistent espionage that's going on in order for our adversaries to industrially get ahead of us. In other words, undercut us financially. So this becomes an economic problem as well as one of national security. So back kind of to the DOD thing, just a little cast over our shoulders. I mentioned Moonlight Maze there a moment ago. This stuff actually started back in the early 90s. We saw attacks against the Air Force, Rome Labs, fairly famous case. Thought it was a whole bunch of very bad people. Turns out it's a couple of teenagers that are acting like bad people. Same sort of thing again happened in 1998 with a case we called Solar Sunrise. It was at the same time that we're bombing Baghdad. Remember the northern no-fly zone, southern no-fly zone stuff in Iraq? And we had told the Iraqis, as long as you stay between those parallels, we'll leave you alone. But every now and then they would get out. So if you remember on CNN, you'd always see, you know, that we'd fire missiles. Well, about that time, the Air Force comes under attack, and it looks like it's coming from the Middle East. So what's the deduction? Wow, the Iraqis must be attacking us in cyberspace. Turns out, it's just a couple of teenagers in California acting like the Iraqis and completely threw us for a loop here. So things like that, we don't know what's going on. Attribution in cyberspace, another one of these areas that we just don't know. This stuff has continued today. We had Moonlight Maze, Storm Cloud, Titan Rain, Byzantine Foothold is the current term that's out there in the press. What happens is when a classified term gets leaked, the Defense Department comes up with a new classified term. The problem doesn't go away. So the current term is classified. When it shows up someday in Time Magazine or whatever, then we'll add it to the slide, and then they'll change the name. But the threat is still there, and the problem consists or persists. The next level down, which is probably where most of us are concerned, is organized crime. Spammers, phishers, criminals, others, people who are largely silent in this game until about 2003-2004 time frame is about where it all started. Remember that? There was kind of an inflection point. I noted it, didn't think a whole lot about it. Christmas of 2003, I saw some spams coming in that were pretty well written and believable. It looked like a PayPal kind of stuff. But what made it very believable was the 1st of January 2004, that spam phishing stuff actually updated the dates, and they did a very good transition, so it looked like this was real stuff. Turns out it's organized crime in Russia, and they're just kind of getting their feet going. Today we still have a big problem there, but the FBI, RCMP, others seem to be perplexed by how do you crack into this organized crime. So why? Well, a survey was done a couple, 3 years ago, and I wish there was more updated value, but I don't have anything better than about 3 years ago, a survey as to what is the value of everything online. That was back when Vista was the brand new operating system. Today it's Windows 7 out of Microsoft. But if you could get a zero day that worked, we know what zero days are, right? All sysadmin types. So we're talking about software that has no patch. It's vulnerability that will work right now with no patching. If I could find something like that, it's to $50,000. But all of you have studied a little bit of economics, and you understand the supply and demand and utilities and value of things. So if there's a lot of something, what happens to its value if there's an abundance of it? Value goes down, right? So if I can get it pretty easily, its cost is small. Look at the values down there at the bottom. So a credit card number, $7. This is 3 years ago. It's less than that now. PayPal, $7. If those things are so cheap, what does that tell you about their abundance? It's easy. It's trivial to get credit card numbers. It's trivial to get access to your PayPal, trivial to get into Amazon, Best Buy, wherever you're doing your online stuff, it's almost worthless now because there is so much of it that the criminal value is that low. That ought to just shock you right to the bone as to what the criminal world has done with you and your information that's out there. Again, a lot of this because we made it that way. We've built these networks to support this. So what the criminal community has found is the internet is almost like this perfect storm. It's a perfect playground for conducting crime. Anonymity is everywhere. There's virtually no laws, no law enforcement. Millions of clueless users. Lots of buggy applications, instantaneous connectivity, data everywhere, value in everything that you find online. It's like when you ask the bank robber, why did you rob the bank? What's the traditional answer? Because it's where the money is, right? Why is organized crime going to the internet? It's where the money is. It's just too easy. Imagine being able to walk into a bank invisible, and there's no armed guard, and the teller has money just laying out on the counter, and you don't even have to ask for it, and they'll just fill your bag, your virtual bag, that they can't see, and they don't even know that you're there. And when you leave, there's no evidence on any cameras, and in fact, the money is still in the bank, but you have a perfect copy of it that's totally legitimate outside in the real world. That's kind of where we are in cyberspace. Would you not take advantage of that if you're a criminal? This is good stuff. We have built the perfect world for these guys. So organized crime used to be big into numbers and rackets, and in fact, 60 Minutes last Sunday night, did you see the interview of John Gotti's son? For those of you who watched 60 Minutes, fascinating interview. Yeah, my dad's a trash collector. You know, that's Mr. Gotti, the big don, right? Well, the organized crime doesn't have to process trash or do collect or construction or the truck just kind of disappeared or it fell off the dock, you know, that kind of stuff. Everything available online now. So we saw, like I mentioned a moment ago, this big transition in 2004. And what we have today is keystroke loggers virtually everywhere. Almost every website you go to uses Java. But how do you know that Java is safe, that scripting stuff behind the scenes? We can point to countless episodes. We saw something happen. We, the Internet Storm Center, Kathy mentioned that in the introduction that I run the... everybody's familiar with the Internet Storm Center? Please say yes. It's your homepage, right? Yeah, when you fire up your web browser, after the RenISAC. You know. RenISAC's first, then the next tab that comes up is the Internet Storm Center, right? Because we talk a lot. But we found at the Internet Storm Center in, I think it was about 2007, the Super Bowl, the Dolphins website, the Dolphins Stadium, got hacked. We didn't realize this. If you go to the Dolphins Stadium site, it looked like the Dolphins Stadium, had a little pretty picture of it and all that. But there was some JavaScript on there that appeared. You could actually see it. You know how up on top of your web browser it tells you where you are? You know, www.whatever. There was actual script up there, you know, the little caret script and then some stuff behind it. Most people wouldn't see that. But it turned out that that script caused if you're using Internet Explorer, this was in early February, and Microsoft had just come out with a patch a couple of weeks earlier, back in January. If you had not applied that patch yet, that scripting caused your machine to go off to Russia, grab some malware, bring it back in. It was known as a browser helper object. This is something Microsoft has built for us. And it plugs it in, and it commences to capture all your keystrokes, but only special keystrokes, those that belong to 50 banks that were programmed into this, and only the first 100 things that you typed into it. So if you went to www.wachovia.com, for example, the first 100 things you type in, it would capture. Well, what are you likely to type in when you visit a website, a bank website? That's all it's interested in. So we saw that. We've seen other cases where sites get poisoned. We start following in. It's not a bank thing. They're going after World of Warcraft credentials, Second Life credentials. Why would the crime world care about the virtual world? There's value. There's lots of value in the virtual world. Yes. Value, value, value everywhere. And that's what the bad guys are going after. Today's attacks in 2010, most of them are not detectable anymore. In fact, what McAfee and Symantec and others offer is really a solution based on the 1990s, early 2000s type of malware problem. They cannot keep up with the new malware, the application attacks, the drive-bys on websites, and this new thing, that this term that's just been coined in the last year, called the advanced persistent threat. If you've not heard about that one, that's another good little Google episode. Go check it out. Dig into it a bit. What we're talking about here is the capability for our adversaries to put code onto your machines that you don't even know it's there. You try and get rid of it, but it has hidden itself in places. And to make it even worse, and this is where, and I'm going to talk about all this stuff in just a moment, where it was first discovered Everybody knows what this is? A little USB key, right? It was found on USB keys, and it was found being able to replicate from sensitive networks to the internet and from the internet to sensitive networks using the USB key as the network. Now think about what that means. All of you are familiar with the April 1st RFCs that are kind of funny, and there was one a few years ago about TCP/IP over avian carriers. Do you remember that one? Okay, so it showed how you could do IP using carriers, you know, one packet at a time taped to the leg of a pigeon. Imagine this being the leg of the pigeon. It's an extremely slow channel, but I could send the virtual equivalent of a SYN packet one way, wait for the ACK, send the SYN ACK, and then start moving data by a USB key very slowly but very persistently. And that's exactly what we found our adversaries doing. And that stuff is sitting inside of your computers, by the way. Almost every computer connected to the internet has some of this garbage inside of it. You just don't know that it's there. That's how complex this problem has come. And so if they can't get you, crime can't get you by networking, they're now getting you by giving you pre-infected machines, right? So why bother connecting to the garbage-filled internet? Let's just go buy it at Best Buy or Amazon online or whatever. When I connect it up, it's already pre-infected. Sounds ludicrous, right? But no, we've seen this in countless cases. I'm going to show you some examples here, including what the FBI has been finding. It's unbelievable. Mentioned GPSs. Was that, did you mention? Who mentioned it? Yeah. Okay, Doug. So you don't like TomTom. Good thing you don't like TomTom. TomTom's infected. It's evil. It has badness on it. Some TomToms were shipped, and now these things run like a little version of Linux. It's pretty cool, right? But it came pre-infected with Windows malware. Now, why would a TomTom come that runs Linux come pre-infected with Windows malware? Yeah, exactly, Kathy. Ding, ding, you win. When you synchronize a thing with likely to be Windows computer, what's it going to do? Yeah. Now, your cars, luckily, unless you drive some real fancy schmancy high-end, you know, Lexus or something, don't have the built-in GPSs, but if you did, it's probably running some kind of Linux thing inside of it. But just imagine pre-infected cars. Ready to go with Bluetooth turned on. So as soon as you drive in the driveway, you now infect your home network with your infected car that you just bought at the Lexus dealer. Could that be done? Of course. All of this is extremely possible. Hard drives coming out of Mac store a few years ago, pre-infected. These were not going to the United States, by the way. These were heading to Russia and Saudi Arabia and other places, which means that we're not the only ones being hit by this crap. It's going to other countries as well. The big turning point, what got a lot of people's attention, were digital photo frames. Remember these things? Everybody's got them? Yeah, so the last three Christmases in a row, Christmas of 07, 08, and even this past December, at the Internet Storm Center, we've been alerted by people, our readers, who are buying these digital photo frames. As soon as they bring them home, they give them as a gift. You take it out from under the tree, you plug it into your home computer, and it blue screens or AV lights up or whatever. They're coming from the factory pre-infected. Now, does that mean we're being targeted by a malicious government? Maybe. What most of the investigations have revealed, though, is this is likely to do with hygiene conditions at the factory. So imagine a factory that's creating digital photo frames. Every hundredth or so probably would be taken off the assembly line, plugged into a quality control machine just to make sure it works. And this is normal QC kind of stuff. If it works, lights up, little, you know, operating system, it all works. It's taken back off the QC, put back on the assembly line. It continues on to get boxed up, and off it goes to Costco or wherever it's going to wind up. But what if that testing machine is infected? What's it likely to do with that malware that's on the testing machine? It's transferred into one photo frame. And this is the best explanation that we've been able to come up with, is the factories aren't clean. They're not sanitary in a digital sense. So you get malware in there from factory workers and others that then gets put randomly onto the components or the stuff that's coming out. We think that's the best explanation. But it could be more nefarious. There could be more behind it. For example, a couple years ago, we had a problem in Washington where USB keys were being found distributed. Now, this is not pen testing. We read about this, where pen testing companies were doing this, but various government facilities around Washington, little pen drives, USB drives, were found just in random locations, many of them containing malicious code. This is before the advanced persistent threat concept got going. This was an email that circulated around Washington, talked about how all this stuff worked. It was the first kind of notice that something bad is happening. This is just 2 years ago. At about the same time in Afghanistan, roughly the summer of 2008 as well. Some soldiers there started to report that pen drives that they're buying brand new. In other words, you go down to the local bazaar there in Afghanistan, you're buying from what you think is a reputable dealer a USB pen drive. As soon as you take it out of the plastic, plug it into a Windows machine, AV lights up and shows that there's malware on it. Coming from brand new USB keys in Afghanistan, but nowhere else. Is that an accident at the factory? Now you got to start wondering, is this targeted or not? Now, luckily, this was old malware. It was caught by Symantec. Not a big deal. It's just the location is scary. So take pause here for just a second. You're walking down the sidewalk. You see a piece of chewing gum, and you see a USB key. Okay? Everybody got the visual? A piece of Wrigley's Spearmint or Trident and a USB key laying side by side. Which one are you likely to pick up and put in your pocket? Which one are you likely to put into your mouth? Would you pick up a stick of chewing gum off the sidewalk and put it in your mouth? Would you? Would you pick up a USB key that you've never seen before, bring it back to your office, and shove it into an orifice? Not your mouth, but an orifice nonetheless, right? It's the mouth of your computer, if you want to think of it. You do it without even thinking, right? What on earth is the difference, folks? Culturally, how did we screw this up? We've taught our kids, little Johnny, you don't know where that nickel's been, that dollar bill, that stick of gum. Don't put it in your mouth. But what are we teaching ourselves about USB sticks, CDs, other types of media, things we just find randomly laying around? You see the problem we got here? It's a social problem. We've trained ourselves very well to keep our bodies safe. We don't want to put foreign objects into our bodies because we're fearful of what it might cause. But we're very willing to put foreign objects into our digital friends, into our computers and other things around us. We're not even giving a second thought as to what this might cause. The world is different today. The games have changed, or the rules have changed. The game's the same, but the rule has changed. We cannot keep doing this nonsense of just thinking that there's no problem in cyberspace. Now, some of you, of course, I've seen this reaction here. You cock back, say, yeah, but, you know, this stuff doesn't work in Windows. You know, the auto run is turned off, blah, 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 blah. True. For your average Windows user, sticking in a USB key, there's no effect. That's fine. Put in a CD, though, and out of the box, Windows likes to run the CD. So technically, what's going on here? The way Microsoft built their operating systems, I'll just ding Microsoft, but Apple, Linux, everybody's guilty of this stuff. When a CD is put in, or actually any type of external media, the operating system asks, what are you? It's part of that plug-and-play kind of stuff. And it'll respond, and it'll give an honest, quote-unquote, answer. Remember the 1970s mindset? Trust built into all this? And the operating system trusts it when it says, I am a CD. And the operating system says, fine, Mr. CD, where do you want to go today? And it says, I want to autoplay. Here's autorun.inf. Here's what I need you to do. And the operating system then follows those instructions. And it runs the DVD, turns on the audio, whatever INF file tells it to do. USB key, plug it in. Says, what are you? It says, I'm a USB key. Windows says, stop. Okay, malware, danger close. The best I'll do is pop up a little thing for the user that says, what do you want to do? Do you want to open up the photographs? Do you want to do the file explorer? What do you want to do? But what if the USB key lies and says, I'm a CD player? What's the operating system going to do? Where'd you autorun.inf? Happy. I'm glad to see you, Mr. CD. What can I do for you? There's nothing to keep the USB key from lying. And that's exactly what this technology called U3 has done. I don't know if any of you have played around with the U3 little thumb drives, but they have a little foolishness inside of it that tells the operating system that they're a CD, not a USB key. So if they can do that, the criminals can do it, and anybody can bypass this stuff. We're just opening it up, we make it available, and anybody can take advantage of it. So let me start kind of winding this down. Last big area I want to talk about. The FBI has been looking into lots of counterfeit issues. It's bigger than just infecting, putting malware, you know, giving you a value-added feature on something that otherwise is very, very legitimate. What if I completely change the hardware and give you a complete different thing, a line card, a motherboard, whatever, that's totally fake? It's not just the software has been infected, but the entire hardware now is different. We've all seen this happen in the physical world. I can go over to various stores in Korea and whatnot, and I can buy fake Nikes, I can buy fake blue jeans, you know, fake golf clubs, all kind of fake stuff. Everybody's seen that phenomenon, right? Well, what unfortunately has happened is I can also buy fake Cisco routers, I can buy fake Dell computers, I can buy fake monitors. I all got the nice little labels on there. Remember these factories I was talking about that are being built that are exact copies of those in the United States? We have a huge problem in Asia with no respect for intellectual property and just building things that are being flooded into the cheap market. And here we sit in the United States where we think we're doing the right thing. We're going to order something. We go online looking for it. Ah, there it is, a whole lot cheaper than over here. Let's get the cheaper source because we're in a resource-constrained world. The FBI started digging into this, and I'm not picking on Cisco because that was the focus of their investigation, but let me just show you some of the stuff they found. It was phenomenal. For example, here's a line card out of a router. Can you tell the difference between the one on the left and the one on the right, other than, you know, we've got some things that are circled on here? They look exactly the same, right? And if you look at this, when you get the PDFs, if you want to look at it, there is virtually no difference. The stickers are the same, the little security seals. If you look, it says jack is too close to the card. See how the jack is a little different there? We start digging in, the screws are a little bit different. Some of the welding is not exactly the same, or the soldering. But if you didn't have the original to compare the fake, would you know the difference? No. Now go online. Look the same card up. You can do this tonight when you get online. Look this card up. Just do a Google search for a Cisco equipment. And you're going to find, like, check this out. List price $1,000. Today's price $99. Is that a genuine Cisco part? What do you think? Of course, yes, it's online, it's the internet, it must be true. My parents say everything online is true, right? You save 90%. Folks, are you going to order this card? You might not, but you put the requisition in through your supply system in your organization, and somebody down there who's just counting beans and bullets goes online and says, hey, I can find this thing for 90% off. Let me just order this. I'm going to save a whole bunch of money. The card comes in the mail to you, pull it out of the box. Can you tell the difference? It looks exactly the same. And if you look around on eBay, same thing. Here's the same line card on eBay, ranging from $17.95 up to buy it now for $150. Genuine or fake? I kind of doubt that this stuff is genuine. Now, the product coming out of China, which really amazes me, you go to Chinese websites and start looking around, and they've got the same stuff. They put the same pictures on these Chinese websites, and they talk about the problem of fake equipment. So it's not that they don't know there's a problem. They're talking about it. Research is now showing that of all the IT products, hardware stuff that's out there, we're talking roughly 1 in 10 now appear to be counterfeit. 1 in 10, folks. That is a problem. If it was down around 1% or less, yeah, we could kind of play around with it. But we're now showing roughly 10% and growing. Customs, FBI, others, their hands are tied. Could you imagine at the customs port of entry in California, Savannah, New York, wherever, trying to open up boxes of electronics and determine whether what's inside of it is real or not? Customs can't do that. FBI trying to work with the Chinese shipping authorities because, yeah, this is a violation of mail rules because I'm mailing fake stuff. That might be a violation. But could you imagine trying to work with foreign governments in terms of shipping? You can see the issues that we're running into. So what's the purpose here? Is it espionage? Is it profit? Are we targeting people? Where is this stuff going? We don't really know. What does this mean to our critical infrastructures? What does it mean to your networks, your computers, your servers, your equipment, the air conditioning systems, all the stuff that's around us? Is it real or is it fake? What this is really standing up, and the point of why we're in here talking, is what the Customs and Border people say, this is a real and present danger to our national security. It's a quote from the federal government. They recognize how bad this is getting. Now, this is focused, of course, on just the illegal or the counterfeit stuff. But you can make the case for everything we've talked about so far. We are at a crisis point in our country. We have created this monster, this hyper-networked world of ours that we all believe in, all have trust in, but yet what we're looking at, or a large part of what we're looking at, we don't even know if it's real anymore. We don't know what's live and what's fake. We don't know what's genuine or what's counterfeit. We don't know where we're going, but yet we believe that it's all working, and it's all trustworthy, and it's all good. And so as we go into this national security problem, we face other realities. What do we do about it? Does Congress pass more laws? Does the White House go out and do executive orders and presidential signing statements and things like that? Does industry change things? Does academia, what's your role? Is it all of our fault? Is it nobody's fault? Can we blame it on the Russians? What do we do, folks? Where do we go with this? And what most people come to the conclusion, no one organization is going to solve this. This is not a pure government problem. It's not a pure industry problem. It's not a pure academic problem. It's not even up to us individually, but all of us collectively have got to work together to solve this. There's a lot of room for leadership, a lot that I think in academia that we can do to move forward. So here's some outcomes, some scary outcomes. We could technically try and solve this problem. We could change coding standards. You know, there's a lot of software issues, C++, Java, others that have these persistent problems. Why do we still have buffer overflows? Why are there still format string attacks? Why is this stuff still there? Why haven't we just gotten rid of all those compilers that allow this stuff to happen? What's wrong with us in terms of software? Could we solve it technically? Do we want to wait for the government to come up with a political solution? Do we want them to take over the internet, just nationalize this stuff, run it all for us because we seem to not be able to do it? Do we want to go down the legal road where we sue the pants off of everybody who's creating subverted products or running buggy networks? Is that the route? Make all the lawyers wealthy? Or do we want to go down the road of maybe industry runs this? In other words, you insource rather than outsource. You bring stuff from offshore back onshore. Or you build your own networks. And to heck with this open internet stuff. Let's just start building walled gardens and closed networks. And there's probably other solutions, but these are the ones that are floating around Washington, real-world things that we're talking about. Now, I'm out of time, but maybe next time if I come back, there's a whole bunch of other things we can talk about. We haven't even mentioned in here. Things like network neutrality and broadband plans and wireless and my evil subject, deep packet inspection. Oh, I love it when that one floats around Washington because everybody thinks it's so bad. But we've been inspecting packets all the way back to when packets were invented, so what the heck's the problem with DPI? But anyway, grid alliance, healthcare, I mean, the world goes on and on. So maybe future, we can talk about that. But right now, just to wrap this up, some thoughts, closing thoughts. We're in Washington, in the policy world, we talk about policy windows. There was a policy window for healthcare, and they were able to get the healthcare bill through. Everybody wanted healthcare reform. There's a window that's open for immigration, for things like that. There's also a window open right now for cybersecurity. It's a huge policy opportunity, a way for us to actually make change before we lose interest in it and the window closes. It's an opportunity for academia, it's an opportunity for industry, for law enforcement, for all types of people to take advantage of this. The problem that I fear is that we're aware that this window is open, but we're not going to do anything about it. Society will just continue to plod along, the networks will continue to get worse and worse, and eventually something bad's going to happen. We are globalized. We are post-industrial. We don't go back to the world we had 20 years ago. It's just not going to happen. We have to face this future reality. So I know I've totally ruined your morning. I can see the looks on your faces like, crap, why did I come to Atlanta to hear all this stuff? But that's my job. My job is to inspire you and make you think of strange things. So I think I have about 3 minutes left. There is a single microphone right here in the middle. If anybody has any questions, promise me you're not going to puke on me. Because I know I destroyed your breakfast. Any questions, thoughts, comments?
I do have one question from an internet participant who's asking about the concept of national security and U.S. infrastructure protection, the idea that a presidential task force can turn off the internet. And can you comment on that proposal?
Certainly. So there was a bill proposed in the Senate about this time last year, April of last year, called the Rockefeller Snow Bill. Some of you might have heard of this. It's in its fourth generation. The first generation of that bill did include a provision that people like to call the internet kill switch. The way the language read made it sound like the president would have right underneath his desk this button that he could hit. Click that button and the internet stops. Okay. We all run networks. Can you do that? Is it, even if we passed a law, even if the president said, that's the most awesome thing in the world, Mark, come down here and build me this button, kind of like you get it at Staples, the easy button, you know, just right there where the president can slap, could we actually turn off the internet today? No, we can't. That's another one of these really crazy insights. We have built, it's almost like watching The Matrix. We have built this machine that we can't turn off. And I don't know, even if we gave the president a button, maybe we could turn off his internet. And he would think that the rest of the internet's gone. Maybe that's a... Maybe, pardon me? Include Congress. Okay, we'll shut down Washington. Then everybody thinks, and then all is well across the fruited plain. But no, they took that provision out. Once the second draft came around, that thing's gone, so we don't need to worry about the president turning off the internet. But great question from whoever sent that in online. Yes, sir.
Hi. Yes, you mentioned that there are some good bills and some bad bills. Can you identify those?
Right. So the Rockefeller Snow thing, for example, it had a lot of good provisions inside of it. The first of its bills that came out, there's been some argument. For example, one of the things that they said in there was that everybody in the cybersecurity profession needs to be licensed and certified. Interesting idea. In other professions, we do this. To practice law, to be a doctor, to be a real estate professional, heck, to cut the toenails on my dog, you got to have a license to practice that, to be a profession in that professional sense, or be a professional in that profession. But in cybersecurity, the security world, yeah, we've got things, tests you can take, you know, the CISSP, SAN, stuff like that, but none of them are licenses per se. None of them have financial responsibility behind it. So that's kind of where they were going in there. The words have definitely softened up now in terms of what it means. And what they're looking at is that if you are a government official or you're doing work with the government, this certification stuff may apply. Other bills, if you start digging into network neutrality, you start looking at some of the other, let the FCC run the internet, some of that stuff that's floating around, read the language. A lot of it's very, very political and doesn't have anything to do with reality. It's like the kill switch for the internet. It sounds great on paper. Technically dig into it, it just can't be done. The networks don't work that way. So those are the kind of things that we're seeing. I hope you can pay attention. For those of you who never get to Washington, and I don't blame you if you don't want to come because it is a swamp, literally built in a swamp. There's probably a reason for that. But do check out the Library of Congress's website, thomas.loc.gov. You can find the text of all the bills in there. From time to time, just entertain yourself and type in some search terms, cybersecurity, you know, things like that, and look at what Congress is baking. It'll astound you as to what your elected officials are putting in writing and actually want to pass as an act of Congress. So even if you don't want to come to Washington, just sort of pay attention to that and work with your local congressman. Yes, sir.
Hi. Earlier this year, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton admonished the Chinese government for allowing the Chinese hackers into many of our companies. I work at Washington University, and a lot of our data, specifically we have a lot of moon data and Mars data, terabytes of it, it's all public.
It's all backed up in China.
It's all public. You can come to the university site and get all this Mars data.
Sure.
That's one example of lots of research that's public.
Yep.
What specifically do the Chinese hackers want from .edu's?
What do they want from your data?
From universities.
So most of what we have collected in colleges and universities is based on funded research. Who's funding? Our funding, right? Okay, we funded it, we paid for it, we've got that research. Yes, we're making it public. But there's a lot of raw information that's not necessarily public, and certainly stuff that wasn't paid for by others. You enjoy, if you're a researcher, the ability to collect information, analyze it, and publish, right? If you're just making raw information available to others, some people are okay with that, but others would rather not, because then published papers may come of your research, of which you have no control over. It's kind of a philosophy of who owns the data. And particularly when your tax dollars are paying for it, that's kind of awkward. Is it really, should it stay in the United States if it's paid for by U.S. tax dollars? Can I go to China and find the same thing, research that's funded by the Chinese government that's freely available for giveaway? Can I go to Israel and find that? France, Germany, just name any of the other 200 countries. We, the United States, are a very, very giving collection of people. But how much is enough? At what point have we bleed our intellectual property and our intellectual capability to others who then take advantage of it, don't give anything back, take advantage of our openness and our charity and throw it back at us into our face? It's a very awkward question. We want to be open, but we have to watch. One little anecdote here. System administrator, University of Texas, contacted me a few years ago, said he could see on his networks SSH traffic going back to China coming out of dorm rooms. Had no idea what this meant. Could you look at it? We studied it for a few days. Lots of dorm rooms, kids would come back from their classes, they'd set up their little SSH connections back into China. Terabytes of information coming out of the University of Texas in Austin going back to China. Why would you see that? Why are these SSH connections coming out of dorm rooms going back to China? Are they wanting to secure their Facebook accounts or do secure email? Of course not. Pardon me? 1,000 grains of sand, yes. Little miniature vacuum cleaners that are just sucking the life out of the University of Texas, in this case, pushing it back to University of someplace else, where they can then claim that they've conducted that research. How much does that cost the people on the other end? Virtually nothing. And I say a lot of bad things about China. It's not just China. Other countries are doing the same thing. Okay, we point to China because they're big in the press, but it's not just them. Last question. I know we have to wrap it up.
Well, you talked about the fact that you can have poisoned parts that go over and build systems that fail catastrophically. And then you talked about parts that are available that have malware in them. And then you talked about fake parts. The logical conclusion is that fake parts could be built with triggers that make them fail catastrophically. And in the network infrastructure, what are we going to do about that?
Absolutely. And that is one of the biggest concerns of many of us that are network infrastructure operators, not even just talking about factories and things, is, for example, at Verizon, where we spend millions of dollars on equipment, high-end Juniper, Cisco type stuff. How do I know that it's not carrying some kind of logic bomb, some back door, some something in there that could detonate in the future, controlled by some foreign adversary or even a domestic adversary for that matter? We don't know. And then if you get outside of networking and go into the critical infrastructures, gas and oil, transportation, just let me give you a chilling closing thought here. It's what I'm working on in my PhD research. We're starting to see a strange increase in failures in computer systems. One thing I like to point to, and I'm not making any conclusions here, but last year Air France lost a huge aircraft that took off out of Brazil, hit thunderstorms, was lost over the Atlantic, not a trace of it to be found. What they think is it was a software problem. In other words, the pilots lost control. It's an aircraft that you have to have a computer in the middle because a human mind cannot get itself around all the control features of the airplane. So when the software fails, this highly complex system fails and kills people. What caused the software to fail? Was it malicious? Is it intentional? Or was it just an, oh crap, we forgot that latest Windows patch? I kind of got that one. We've seen in Washington metro trains with software problems that rear end each other. We see Toyota today, software problems in their cars that are failing and killing people. Is any of this malicious? I'm not trying to draw any conclusions, but the trends are very unnerving here in this dependence on software. So anyway, I've talked enough, and I hope you have a great conference. Thank you very, very much.
A speech by Marcus Sachs, Executive Director for National Security and Cyber Policy at Verizon. I'm Jerry Bain for EDUCAUSE. Thanks for listening.